Now please help me welcome our main speaker tonight, Tina A. from Hollister.
I didn't want to fall in that crack right there, so I went this way. Hi, you guys. My name's Tina Albert, and I'm an alcoholic. And I'm super grateful to be here and be sober tonight. And welcome to those of you who might be new or relatively new to Alcoholics Anonymous. I know nobody introduced themselves as new. I think I'm like, I call BS. Gosh, so let's just do this. Thank you to Lee for asking me to come and be with you guys this evening, even though he's not here, whatever, I won't take it personal. Might make a tenth step, but whatever. John, thank you for hosting. Chris, thank you for your 10-minute talk. Mark, thank you for coming and helping and being with me and driving down here and making our trip so much fun. Thank you to everybody that fed me. That was my favorite part of the night. I love Alcoholics Anonymous, you guys, and it seems like the longer that I stay sober, the more enamored I am with the fellowship and the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I differentiate those because they're different, right? I think the fellowship is different than the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I remember being brand new in here. My sobriety date is the 10th day of October in 1984, which means that I'm 41 and a half years sober, and I remember like it was yesterday the desperation that I walked in here with. And so if you're new or kind of new in here, I hope you know that every single one of us walked in here feeling that way too. And I hope I never forget what that felt like because that has enabled me to continue to keep coming back for the last 41 years. And I love this thing. I remember being super new in here. I was sick when I got sober, super, super sick. And one of the old timers, I overheard him talking to somebody and he was like, oh, she's going to be great because look at her. She's just destroyed. And that was the truth, man. I crawled in here at the ripe old age of 20. I'm the president and founder of Your Never Had a Legal Drink Club. And I found out much later that I wasn't really the president and founder, but I got sober in this little Alano Club in Southern California called Birch Street, Southwest Alano Club. And everybody in there was 86 to 132. And I was certain that I was the president and founder of the Never Had a Legal Drink Club. And you guys used to say preposterous things to me when I was new, like I never have to drink again for the rest of my life, 24 hours at a time. And I remember looking at you guys and thinking, it's really easy for you to say that because you only have 3 days left. But that's not the solution that I came to Alcoholics Anonymous looking for. I just came in here because I wanted to take a break. I wanted to take a break, and I was really, really tired. And if you're new or kind of new in here, whether you introduced yourselves or not, I hope you're tired. And also, if you're not new in Alcoholics Anonymous, I heard somebody say a long time ago, if you're in your first 30 days or if you're in your last 30 days, welcome to Alcoholics Anonymous. And that sparked my attention because I've been that girl in here a couple of times, right in the middle of Alcoholics Anonymous, suffering from untreated alcoholism, dying a day at a time right in your midst. Full of this spiritual arrogance that disallowed me the privilege of coming in here and telling you guys that I needed you because I thought I was supposed to be like more sober than that or something. And the funny thing is, the longer that I stay sober, the more clear I am that I just have a daily reprieve contingent on the maintenance of my spiritual condition. 41 and a half years sober, and I just have a day. I just got a day to do my best to bring God's intention and will into my life and be the best manifestation of a power that I know how to be. And sometimes that's a pretty good manifestation, and sometimes it's not. Sometimes I am a hot mess right in the middle of Alcoholics Anonymous. And the thing that I love the most is regardless of how preposterous my behavior can be, like you guys have never told me that I wasn't welcomed here, that I couldn't stay. And I can tell you that getting sober at 20 years old, I did absolutely every single thing you could possibly do wrong in Alcoholics Anonymous, except one thing. The only thing that I have not done wrong since the 10th day of October in 1984 was wake up with whiskey on my breath. It's the only thing that I've done to perfection for 41 years, and all the rest of it I've blown monstrously. And you guys just kind of laugh at me and let me keep coming back. And the thing that I remember oftentimes is that it's never the boneheaded mistakes that I make in sobriety that make me thirsty. It's my need to defend the mistake. And so I just do my best to come in here and get right with you guys. And that's held me in good stead since I got sober this time. So to tell you a little bit about my drinking and who I was before I got here, I was raised in a little upper middle class beach community in Southern California called Manhattan Beach. And I went to school with a bunch of little girls that were 5 feet tall, and they all had long flowing blonde hair and really pretty blue eyes and these surfer chick tans. They looked like prepubescent Pamela Andersons. I mean, they were just perfect. And I was 5'8" in the seventh grade. I had long stringy reddish hair, buck teeth and freckles. And I would look at these little girls and see perfection. And then I would look in the mirror and I felt like Pippi Longstocking on crack. Like I was just weird. I remember growing up, I felt not good enough, smart enough, pretty enough. I didn't fit in with other people. I didn't know how to do all the things that you guys seem to know how to do naturally. I was just ill at ease and odd and uncomfortable in my own skin. Dr. Silkworth describes me aptly in our doctor's opinion as restless, irritable, and discontented. And I didn't have those words when I was two, but I was restless, irritable, and discontented from the time that I could remember. And I was the kind of kid that would sit around the dinner table with my brothers and sisters and know that my mom loved them way more than she loved me. And I'm an only child, so that'll give you a little peek into the way that my brain works. Like, I just think about me all the time, you guys, and I'm just weird. And I had one friend when I was growing up. She lived a couple houses down from me on the other side of the street, and her name was Melanie, and she was my best friend. And I remember this little girl named Melinda moved into our neighborhood, and I was in the sixth grade, and Melinda moved into the neighborhood, and Melanie decided that Melinda was going to be our new best friend, and I had to beat her up because I was afraid of the competition. Like, I've been consumed with what our literature describes as self-centered fear from the time that I could remember, and my big book tells me that that fear is fear that I'm going to lose something that I possess or fail to gain something that I demand. Not that I would like or wish for, but like I have this series of demands in my life, things that I think must be in order for me to be self-satisfied and happy in my life. And Melinda came into the mix, and I had to beat her up. And all of a sudden, Melinda nor Melanie were my friends anymore. And I was distraught. So I got this new girl named Carrie to be my friend, and we were going into the seventh grade, and Carrie was my new best friend because she was Italian. She had black hair and her teeth were bigger than mine. So I've been seeking lower companions my whole life. And Carrie's my new best friend in the seventh grade, and she decided one day that we were gonna go to her house and cut school and we were gonna drink scotch. And I didn't have anybody in my life that I could see the effects that they got from that drink of alcohol, but I just went to Carrie's house and we cracked the paper seal off of a fifth of scotch, and I took a big pull right out of the bottle, and that stuff burnt all the way down, and it burnt all the way back up. It burnt when it came flying out my nose. It was vile, vile. I hated scotch, and I didn't want to drink any more of the scotch. But I watched Carrie take a drink off of that scotch bottle, and all of a sudden her face got a little bit pink and she started giggling, and she wasn't worried about getting in trouble for cutting school. So I don't know where I came up with this idea. I just knew. I took the bottle from her. I plugged my nose. I held my breath. I chugged the scotch. And just enough of that nasty crap stayed in my stomach for what Dr. Silkworth describes as, see, you can sing it with me if you want to, a sense of ease and comfort that comes at once by taking a drink. Like, oh my God, you guys, for the first time in my life, I was not consumed by self. I swear to God, looking back at that moment today, I swear what happened was my shoulders dropped a couple inches and that crick in my neck went away and I was able to take a nice, long, deep breath and just exhale. I was able to breathe for the first time in my life, and I had no idea that at 12 or 13 years old, I had been holding my breath for my entire life until I was able to breathe, and that just set me free. It was like the magic elixir that seemed to fix everything that I thought was broken on the inside of me. And just to fast forward through that afternoon, because an alcoholic was born that day. I think I had alcoholic tendencies before I picked up that drink. But in the event that there's such a thing as an invisible line between social drinking and alcoholism, I crossed it that day. Either that or I snorted it when I was 13. I'm not sure which. But I drank way too much scotch that afternoon, and Carrie quit drinking the scotch. I kept drinking the scotch. I had large memory gaps throughout the course of that afternoon that you guys told me were something called blackouts. I just thought it was scotch. My mom came banging on the door at noon because the school had called. We were absent. The school called my mom, and she came right to Carrie's house. I don't know why she knew where I was, but right to Carrie's front door she came. In a couple of years, all of your parents were going to start coming to right to my front door because your parents knew where you were getting in trouble too. And my mom's banging on the door and screaming, and we jumped out that bedroom window and climbed over the backyard fence, and I was off on Pippi's first grand adventure. And it was so much fun. I had so much fun that afternoon. We climbed the water tower in Manhattan Beach, and we were jumping over backyard fences, and I was hiding in your dog houses, and I was running from the cops, and they weren't even chasing us. Like, it was so much fun. And about 4 o'clock that afternoon, during this particular time in my life, I was doing the Pippi Goes Chola phase. So I had this reddish hair all ratted up in this Aquanet thing, and I had black eyeliner on, and I was wearing Dickies and Crips lips and running all over Redondo Beach scribbling La Flaca R13 all over the walls in pencil, because, you know. And I decided that the best solution to the problem that I found myself in that day would be to steal a bicycle from the continuation school that had no seat on it, take my friend's 9-year-old brother and put him on the handlebars of the stolen bicycle. I wrapped a chain around my neck and stole a butcher knife from the kitchen for protection. And we ran away from home because, I don't know, like, I don't like to get in trouble. Oh, goodness. I don't like to get in trouble by myself. So I always like to take somebody else with me. And I took this little 9-year-old brother. I told my first sponsor that story, and he goes, baby girl, they call that kidnapping. And I've hated sponsorship from that day to this, because you guys just have this way of looking at stuff. But I took that little boy and ran away from home, and I pedaled us all the way up to East LA, and I was out of scotch, and Sean was crying, and I dumped the bike in a dumpster and called the cops on myself. And they picked us up, and my mom came and got me that day, and she was devastated. And I came to Alcoholics Anonymous 8 years later singing that alcoholic theme song that sounds like, my drinking really doesn't affect anybody but me. I hurt myself way more than I hurt anybody else, and I can tell you that I destroyed my mom that day. I'm so sorry. I'm just watching somebody get carried out of here in a stretcher. So if we could just take a second and I'm so distracted. Just take a second and pray for whoever that is. And God, I love this thing, man. So now I have to start all over again. So it's his fault. Kidding. So I destroyed my mom that day, and for the next 8 years, like, I just made huge messes in my life and wrecked her on a regular basis. And just to fast forward through my drinking, I can tell you that I drank myself into and out of middle school, high school, continuation school. Every job that I ever got, every relationship that I ever found myself in, the United States Navy, whatever. a rehabilitation program in Philadelphia, a psychiatric unit in Anchorage, because I just drink liquor and I do things that are preposterous and bizarre and look a little odd to the untrained eye. And I just wrecked my life. There's one line in our literature that talks about my alcoholism specifically, and it says, with it goes the annihilation of all things worthwhile in life. And that just kind of sums me up. I remember my first sponsor made me look words up in a dictionary because we didn't have the smartphone. So I'm with the big old fat Webster's dictionary, and I'm looking stuff up, and I'm highlighting things in the big book, and he made me look up to the word annihilate. I thought I was smart enough to know what it meant, but I looked it up anyway just to humor the old fool. And what it says is to reduce to nothing. And it kind of grabbed my attention. Because it seems to be what happens to me when I drink. I just reduce to nothing all the things that matter to me in my life. And when I was 17 years old, I was running away from home on a pretty continuous basis, and my mom's hiring these little private investigators trying to find out if her only daughter's dead or alive. And I get tired, and she lets me come home, and I repeat the cycle over and over again. Dr. Silkworth, in our doctor's opinion, says that this is repeated over and over again, that unless we can experience an entire psychic change, there's very little hope in our recovery. And I destroyed that woman on a regular basis. When I was 17, I accidentally enlisted in the United States Navy. I was working at Burger King, and there was a Marine in his dress blue uniform. And I don't know about the rest of you ladies in here, but I love a man in uniform. Maybe a couple of you gentlemen too, no judgment. Like I started with Cub Scouts, and then I like football players and sanitation workers. Like I just don't even care. I gave this guy my phone number, and he started calling me at ridiculous hours, like 10 o'clock in the morning. And I went down there and explained why I was 17 years old with a proficiency certificate from my sophomore year and a high school equivalency. And I found out super quickly that he was not going to let me into his United States Marine Corps. So he took me next door to the Navy office. And in the 1980s, if you could blow on a mirror and it fogged, they would send you to boot camp. And I joke about that. That's not really the truth. I was actually the last female to get into boot camp without a real high school diploma, no more equivalency certificates and GEDs for women, only men. No resentment there, however. But I ended up in boot camp when I was 17 years old, and I can tell you that I was super sick when I was sitting in the recruits and processing barracks, and they had enlisted a budding alcoholic, and they had no idea, and I wasn't super certain of it either. But I detoxed in the recruits and processing barracks 4 days before Christmas. My company formed just after the new year, and I had my first captain's mast, which is like a court if you're a civilian, for drinking in boot camp. I was 5 weeks enlisted, and somebody brought me in beer, and I drank the beer. And now I'm standing in front of my commanding officer, and I'm in trouble. And I didn't want to do that, and I did it anyway. Like, I lack the power of choice when it comes to a drink. If you're new or kind of new in Alcoholics Anonymous and somebody says, like, just don't drink no matter what, it's my suggestion that you run away from them. They're trying to kill you. Chris said it perfectly, like, the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous is my sufficient substitute, and without you guys, I'm doomed. And I drank that beer in boot camp, and I met my first commanding officer. I almost got kicked out. I had my second captain's mast at 5 months enlisted for drinking on a duty weekend and leaving base when I was in A school in Pensacola, Florida, where I was going to school to be a cryptologic technician, which means that I was enlisted to be in naval intelligence, which should frighten you a little. And I spent a little bit of time in the restricted barracks, and I lost a stripe and half my pay for a little while, and they sent me to my first duty station, which was Adak, Alaska. And in 1982, we were spying on Russia. It was in the middle of the Cold War era, or towards the end of it. And I'm secretary to the commanding officer of this little naval security group on this Aleutian island off the Kamchatka Strait in Russia. And all the classified intelligence that we get from our communication stations come across my desk. And I go have a couple of Long Island iced teas on my lunch break, and then I come back and start disseminating this classified information to the wrong people at the wrong commands. And the Navy frowns on that just a little bit. And they sent me to Alcoholics Anonymous in earnest this time. They put me on antabuse. I drank on antabuse only 4 times. If you're going to be an alcoholic, you can't let looking bad stand in your way. You just got to drink right past that. And so I drank on antabuse and ended up super sick. The second time I drank on antabuse, the Navy thought it might be grave emotional and mental disorders, and they sent me to a psych unit in Anchorage. And I left there 3 weeks later completely observed with a recommendation that I be discharged from the military. And I begged my commanding officer for one more shot. He sent me to a rehabilitation program in Philadelphia where I drank on antabuse for the 3rd time at a Sunday Phillies game because there was beer. And I don't know what you do when you're a couple of weeks away from your last drink, but I drink the beer because I can't stand me. Like, I have no idea that I'm without defense against that first drink, that I'm powerless over alcohol because I burn with this guilt and shame and remorse, this self-loathing and hatred that nothing extinguishes but Jack Daniel's whiskey, and I'm without defense against the first drink, and I'm gonna drink it whether I want to or not, seemingly a good idea or a bad idea, seemingly against my own will, I just drink the liquor. And so I drank in that rehabilitation program. I was discharged from there and subsequently from the military, and every single day for 15 months, I swore I was gonna not drink and go to Alcoholics Anonymous. I would wake up in the morning and I would think, today's the day. And then about 1 or 2 o'clock, I would think, maybe like a Coors Light, because that's almost water anyway. Or I will have a wine cooler, because wine doesn't count. And I have no idea that I have this mental obsession or a preoccupation, if you will, with the relief I know that I'm going to get from a drink of liquor. And then once I take any liquor into my system, I'm off and running. I'm powerless over whether I'm going to stop drinking. I drink until liquor's done. I'm not the one that gets to make that distinction anymore. I drink until something physically separates me from liquor, and then I stay sober for as long as I can stand it, and then I drink again. And I did that every day for 15 months. In 1984, I found myself living in a 1971 MG Midget. There's not a lot of leg room in there. I was stealing soap from the boys' market, going to the sand showers in Manhattan Beach and washing up when I got too offensive for my own nostrils, and the parents of my friends that I went to high school with would come past me on the bike path and they would look at me with that look on their face that said, I used to let you spend the night in my home with my daughter, and would you just look at yourself, like, what happened to you? And I would just look at the ground, and I was dirty on the inside and dirty on the outside, and I hated myself, and I didn't really like you guys too much either, but I was just full of this self-loathing. And sitting in that little car one day, I heard this little counselor say, like, he was sitting in the seat next to me, like, kid, if you ever want to get sober, call Alcoholics Anonymous, but you won't, you'll die drunk. And on that day, Wednesday, the 10th day of October in 1984, I got out of the car and I put a dime in the payphone and I called the central office in Torrance. It was the best first, second, and third step that I've done in 41 years in AA. I knew that I was going to drink this bottle of vodka that I had sitting in the passenger seat, whether I wanted to or not. And I thought perhaps those folks in Alcoholics Anonymous might help me not. And then I made a decision that I followed up with a little bit of action, and I put a dime in the payphone and I called the central office, and this little guy named Sam covered the mouthpiece and he said, like, we got a live one. Let's send her to Birch. And they sent me all the way across town to this little Alano club in Hawthorne. And my life began that day. I can tell you that in 41 years in AA, I've had a lot of spiritual experiences. But I believe my very first spiritual experience happened that day in that little 5:30 meeting. And it was you. And I can tell you, subsequently in 41 years being with you, my grandest, most profound spiritual experiences and awakenings have all included you. My big book tells me that I'm obscured from the needed power to live by calamity, pomp, and worship of other things, all of which include me, by the way. I am the thing that obscures me from the power then and now. But in those moments that I seem to be obscured from the needed power to live, I just come into Alcoholics Anonymous and sit with you guys, and the obscurity goes away. I just log into a meeting of Zoom. Like, I know people have whatever opinions they have about Zoom, and hey, if anybody's on there, like, I am the Wednesday Night Pacific Group Zoom host at 6:45 every Wednesday, and I get to host 350 alcoholics for the Pacific Group on Zoom, and I can tell you that that saved my life in the middle of COVID. And sometimes today, living in the middle of a lettuce field, when I feel obscured from the needed power to live, I just log into a meeting on Zoom, and sitting with you guys looking at those little Brady Bunch squares, I am abundantly clear that God is everything. Left to my own devices, I forget that a lot. But when I'm with you guys, I always remember. And so my grandest spiritual experiences have all included you guys. And you've held me up throughout the course of my sobriety when my knees failed to do the job. And I am so incredibly grateful for Alcoholics Anonymous. But I got sober in that little Olano club. I walked into that 5:30 Wednesday night meeting. The topic was relationships, which was perfect because I was looking for a couple. And I just sat there, and you guys brought me coffee a half a cup at a time because you knew in a minute I was going to start shaking and I was probably going to spill the coffee. And you sat next to me. I mean, you took turns because I was a little smelly, so you would rotate. But you would sit next to me, and I never sat there by myself. And at the end of that meeting, I got up to leave, and this lady named Connie followed me out to my little car, and she took my vodka and dumped it into the gutter, and I really thought I was going to just hit her one. Wasn't sure whether I should cry or smack her or lap it up out of the gutter, like, I'm not sure which. And she just, like, put her arm around my shoulders and walked me back into the meeting hall, and we sat there until the 8:30 speaker meeting. And then I went and parked my car back behind the Lano Club because I had nowhere to stay. And Gary, who was the secretary of the 6:45 Attitude Adjustment Meeting, came out in the morning and he knocked on my window and he woke me up and he invited me in and he brought me a toothbrush and some soap and he let me wash up in the bathroom and he let me have all the jelly donuts I wanted before he let you guys in for your little Attitude Adjustment Meeting. I adjusted your attitude and sent you off to work at Northrop and TRW. And then I sat there until 11:30 when you guys would come back on your lunch break for your little nooner. And then I would hang out all day until the 5:30 meeting when you guys would come back while you let the traffic die down for the 5:30 commuter meeting. And then you'd go home and get your little Al-Anonic wives and run back to the 8:30 speaker meeting. And oh my God, it was like this pathetic Groundhog Day over and over again with a little fellowship at Dee's Coffee Shop at 10 o'clock where you'd buy me a $1.99 breakfast and force feed me coffee until 2:01 a.m. when I couldn't get any more liquor, and I'd go vibrate back behind the Olano Club until 6 o'clock the next morning when Gary would come out and bang on the window like, oh my God. And I thought I had died and gone to hell, and I came walking up to the club one day, and you guys were like, oh my God, congratulations. And I had 30 days sober, and I didn't know that I had 30 days sober, but you did. Like, for the first time in my life, somebody else was more interested in me than I was. And you celebrated that 30 days with me. I got a sponsor because you told me the men work with the men and the women with the women, and the men will pat my butt and the women will save it. So I asked this guy named Paul to be my sponsor. He was this old hippie from the 60s, and he had long gray hair, and he wore carpet purses and bandanas and turquoise jewelry, and he spoke with this really Shakespearean English accent, even though he was from Inglewood, California. And we started reading the big book. And I got up to the podium one day and I said, I'm Tina, I'm an alcoholic. And he majestically arose from his seat in the front row and said, that's all you know, sit down now. And I was mortified. And then I had 30 days and I was gonna tell you like all the cool stuff that I learned in rehabs and psych units and from psychiatrists and psychologists, because you guys got sober before the crust of the earth cooled. And so I thought I had like the cutting edge young people's information on alcoholism and I was gonna tell you some stuff. And he stood up one more time and was like, you're finished now. And he had made me your coffee cup washer, so that night I went into the kitchen and I washed the ashtrays first, and then I washed the ceramic cups and the dirty water, because how dare you? And I told you I've done everything wrong in here. I was your secretary and I failed to show up with the key, so you had to have the meeting in the parking lot. I was your treasurer and I stole your money. Like, I've done everything you could possibly do wrong in here, except I haven't drank. And every single time I make a mistake, I do my best to come into Alcoholics Anonymous and make that right. And so I paid you back your money, and I paid penance, and I had other commitments. And the thing that I can tell you is that service keeps me sober then, and it keeps me sober now. When I was new, I was your ashtray putter outer. It was the first commitment that I had, and I would show up and put ashtrays equally from the ends of the long table so your osteoarthritic little old arms could hit your ashtrays with the cigarettes into the ashtray. And then he made me your coffee cup washer, and then I'm your greeter. And by this time, all the Al-Anon women were bringing their teenage daughters' clothing that was too offensive for the little girls to wear. So they would clean out their closet and bring it to me. And I would show up to the meeting in fishnets and mini skirts and hooker heels with that 80s flash dance hair going on. And it was a vision for you. And I'm standing at the door, and I'm your greeter. And I can't hug you, and I can't make eye contact with you, so I just punch you in your arm. When you come into the room, I just punch you. And you guys like rub your arms and you go wandering off, and my sponsor comes walking in and he says, "Would you wear that to church?" And I thought, "Well, no, sir, but it's Friday and there is a dance right after this meeting." And he said, "I'll be damned if you wear it to mine. Go change your clothing." And I went to the trunk, and the trunk of my little 71 MG Midget, and I rooted through for my cleanest dirty clothes, and I changed my clothes in the bathroom. And I gotta tell you, I've never had a man go tell me to put more clothes on in my entire life. And I was angry, and I changed my clothes, and I'm standing at the door, and Paul wasn't the kind of sponsor that let me ask questions about his ridiculous direction. He just expected me to take it. And if I couldn't figure out later how come, he would explain it to me. And a couple weeks later, I was standing at the door, and you guys would walk in, and I might make eye contact with a couple of you, and maybe I'll shake your hand, and I may say something really stupid like, "Hey, John, welcome to Alcoholics Anonymous." And you might say, "Hey, Tina, we're really glad you're here." And I had no idea that by Paul making me change my clothes, he was teaching me how to carry myself with a little bit of grace and dignity in Alcoholics Anonymous. He was changing the way that I viewed myself. I owe that man everything in my life. He passed away on October 10th of 1986. It was the day of my second anniversary in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I thought I was gonna have to leave here, because he was the first safe person in my life that didn't want anything from me but to see me get better in AA. And God, I loved him so much, I thought I was gonna have to leave, and what I did was got another sponsor, and I continue to take the steps. I can tell you that I fought for a long time this concept of a power greater than myself. I'm 41 and a half years sober, and I describe myself as an alcoholic of the agnostic variety, even today. And people look at me a little bit weird, because that doesn't sound sexy when you have four decades sober. But I used to think to be agnostic meant that I didn't believe in God. And the truth is, I have an overwhelming conviction and relationship with a power greater than myself. I always have. I used to deny it a lot. And the truth of the matter is, I got Connie at 2 years sober. And up until that point, you guys would talk about God in meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. I would sit right in the front row and go, every time you would say God, to make sure you knew I didn't like your topic of conversation. And you guys would look at me, and I would roll my eyes and suck my teeth, and I may or may not get up to the podium and crosstalk you, and you would say really dumb stuff to me like, "Baby girl, if God runs you out of Alcoholics Anonymous, booze will run your rusty butt right back in here." Ah, like you thought you were so funny. And I got this second sponsor. When Paul passed away, it was Connie. It was the lady that dumped the vodka out in the gutter. And I'm still in relationship with that woman today. From the day that I got sober in Alcoholics Anonymous, I talked to her 2 days ago. And what she had me do was start to look at some old ideas that I had about the power. And it was really easy for me to look back over the course of my life and see some just atrocious things that had happened to me and places that I had put myself in positions to be harmed and whatever, and come to this belief that if there was really a loving power, he wouldn't want anything to do with me. Why would he let all these things happen to me? And if there's really a loving power, like I have done some things and been some places, that would disallow me the privilege of having a relationship with that power. And so I just disavow belief in the power. But I've never not believed in God. I just thought perhaps God didn't believe in me, and it was so much easier to just not try, you know? And I can tell you, being agnostic in Alcoholics Anonymous is okay. What my 11th step tells me is that I have to seek the power. Nowhere does it say I have to find the power. Just says that I have to seek the power. And so for 41 years, I've sought the power. And I seek the power in meadows and streams and forests and deserts. And I pray in synagogues and Catholic churches and Pentecostal four-square churches where they like speak in tongues. And I think like there's all kinds of bizarre stuff going on. I've climbed underneath pyramids in Egypt and walk the Via Dolorosa in Israel, and I seek the power. And the crazy thing is, every single place that I look for the power, I find the power. And I believe that. My belief doesn't have to be anybody else's, that it's just like the like this mountain that we're all trying to climb to the top of, and God is the pinnacle of the mountain, and we're all just taking different paths up different sides, but we're all getting to the same place at the end. And I have a phenomenal life in your midst. I was sponsored by Connie for a whole bunch of years, and I had children and got married in that order. Don't judge me. I was 3 years sober and I wanted a baby, not a man. So I just went about making myself one almost all by myself. And and 3 days after my third anniversary in Alcoholics Anonymous, I gave birth to this little thing that I had no idea how to take care of. And I was living in my mom's house because that's where any good newcomer alcoholic having a baby out of wedlock lives, with their mother. And I was unemployable and just a hot mess. And I had this little baby, and I remember looking at that little boy and feeling like I was watching my heartbeat on the outside of my chest for the first time in my life. And I looked at that little guy and I made a decision that I was going to do the absolute best that I could to stay sober a day at a time for the rest of my life and be the best mom that I knew how to be to him. And the folks in Alcoholics Anonymous taught me how to do that. My sponsor was Matthew's godmother. Connie was his godmother. And you guys gave me this baby shower, and there were like 200 people there, and we had this big fish fry because all the guys at Birch were fishermen. So they brought all the fish in and they cooked the fish fry, and I got absolutely every single thing that I could possibly need for that little boy all the way up until he was like 18 months old. Like all the clothes, all the diapers, like the crib and the mattress and the car seat, and like everything. And Maddie was like Birch's little mascot, and I would come into meetings and you guys would take turns holding him so that I could sit in meetings and be present in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I would get to leave there a sober mom. And God, I fell in love with that little guy, and I have a little tattoo on my arm that's got like a compass rose, because I always said he was my true north, and when it was really dark, I could always look to him to guide me. And I got to raise that little boy in Alcoholics Anonymous, and it's the greatest blessing of my life. I got married a couple years after that, and Chris and I had another baby. His name's Dylan. They're 4 years apart, and I was living this incredible life in the middle of Alcoholics Anonymous, like married, two kids, two dogs, white picket fence, like half an acre in Norco with horses in the backyard, like living a charmed life in the middle of you guys, because I just take the actions that you guys teach me how to take that hold me at good stead in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I remember being 13 years sober and going on this cruise for my 13th birthday, and I was dressed in this lacy gown. It was Saturday night. My hair was made up and I had my makeup on, and Chris was with me. We had taken my sponsor, Connie, and her husband on the cruise because we celebrate our birthdays on the same day, the 10th of October. And so the four of us are on this little cruise, and it's Saturday night, and they invite us to have dinner at the captain's table. And I'm thinking, like, I am a dishonored Navy veteran. I was discharged from the military for chronic alcoholism and drinking in rehab. And I'm sitting at the captain's table. We got a tour of the bridge, and I'm sitting at the captain's table. And after the dinner that night, Chris went down to close the casino, whatever. It's another 12-step program. And I decided that I wanted to go to the Friends of Bill meeting. And so I went downstairs looking for the AA meeting. It was a little 3-day booze cruise to Ensenada, and I was the only one there. So I went back upstairs, and I was standing on the deck of this cruise ship, and there were a million stars, and there was a full moon, and all of these wispy clouds, and the moon was peeking out from behind the clouds, and it looked like every single one of the little white caps coming off the ship had a light underneath it. It was just this magical fairy tale moment, and I remember standing there talking to all my old timers, and I was telling them, whoever thought I could have a life like this? And I know that Paul Mattson looked at me on October 10th of 1984, and he saw a sober member in Alcoholics Anonymous, and my mama Helen looked at me and she saw a mother, and Connie looked at me and she saw a wife, and Frank and Francie Priest looked at me and they saw a daughter. You guys looked at this feral little homeless girl, and I swear to God, you breathed every single thing that I am today into my very being, like you've created me in your dream time. And I could never repay Alcoholics Anonymous. Standing there, it was like every single one of my old timers was right behind me, and when I said whoever thought, I could hear them all say, we did, baby girl. Like, I love this life that you guys have spoon fed me for 41 and a half years, and every single thing that I have that's good and right and proper in my life is because I stay here with you guys. And I do my best to continue to practice these 12 steps and do my best to carry the message to alcoholics. I sponsor a whole bunch of knuckleheads, and I'm currently sponsored by Sharon, who was up here last week with her husband Pete. It's super important for me to be actively sponsored in Alcoholics Anonymous because I have really good ideas. and Sharon most often requires me to run them past her. And when she's finished laughing at me, we course correct. And that's her line, not mine. Course correction! I hate that. But I do my best to do what she asks me to. And what I've learned is that that I can't see the whole picture when I'm on the inside of the frame. And I was married to Chris for a bazillion years, and at 21 and a half years sober, he decided that he wanted something different in his life. And he left our marriage in an unceremonious fashion. And I was devastated, you guys, in the fetal position on the floor in my bedroom. Thinking that I couldn't stay sober. I thought everything that I had worked for that made me who I was in Alcoholics Anonymous was being stripped away. And I don't know what you guys do when your life looks like that, but I am the one that our literature says suffers from the delusion that I could wrest a little satisfaction and happiness out of the world by managing well. And what was not already broken in my life, I smashed by the time that process was over. And laying on the floor, I opened my 12 and 12 to step 11, which was a funny step for it to open to. It was not one where the binding would normally crack, whatever. Not my favorite. I used to think it was extra credit. And it opened to this page that said, sometimes the hand of God seems heavy and unjust, and it's during these times that new lessons are learned and new resources of strength are uncovered. And it goes on to say that all of us at times are seized with a rebellion so sickening that we simply refuse to pray. And the really cool thing is that the next paragraph says that when this happens, we shouldn't think too poorly of ourselves. We should just resume that practice as soon as we're able. And that's been my experience since I've been here. Like Chris talked about surrender, like that white flag of surrender. And for 41 years, I've torn corners off of the white flag of surrender and thrown them into the pot and held the rest of it behind my back because you can have this, but I'm keeping this. I'm like the carny at the shell game. And after a while, I can't remember what pieces of my life are under what shell. But my life looks like a series of surrenders in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I hope that I never forget that. Every time I think that I'm all in, there's always something else for me to surrender. And my marriage ended and I thought I couldn't stay sober, and I stayed sober. And when I was new, Paul told me that if I was to quit drinking, I couldn't have any lurking notions or reservations that someday I would drink successfully again. And if I had them, what were they? And I remember telling him that my 21st birthday, I had to drink because, you know, if I got married, I had to drink because you have to toast with champagne. If I ever got divorced, that would be a whiskey day. And I have turned 21, obviously, and I've been married and divorced, none of which have required me to drink. I remember telling him if anything happened to my mom, I wasn't going to be able to stay sober. And if I'm ever blessed with a child and something happens to that baby, I'm going to have to go. And I was sponsored by Clancy for a whole bunch of years. And Clance died on August 24th of 2020, right in the middle of COVID. It was a Monday. And I remember getting a call from his daughter letting me know that her father had passed. And then 2 days later, I accidentally asked Sharon to be my sponsor because I was going through a whole bunch of stuff that I needed like somebody else's eyeballs on. And my mom was suffering from a little bit of cognitive decline, if you will. It was kind of a rapid cognitive decline that we believed to be Lewy body dementia. And she wasn't able to care for herself anymore. And she was leaving the stove on and getting in the car and going places she shouldn't be and then getting lost. And I was getting calls from people that had my little mom, that shouldn't have my little mom. And I was trying to figure out what to do. And Sharon and I were going over some stuff because Clancy wasn't able to like be there during that time. He had broken his hip and he was in a care facility. And so I was talking to Sharon, and on Wednesday I called her up and we were making a decision about whether or not I was gonna sell my house and my mom's property and move back up to Hollister where I raised my kids because I'd moved back to Los Angeles. And so Wednesday I accidentally and very unceremoniously asked Sharon to be my sponsor, and I think she was as shocked as I was, whatever. And then Friday we made the decision that we were gonna list my mom's property, and I signed the paperwork at 9 o'clock. Somewhere you guys turned me into my mom's safe place, and all of a sudden I'm her medical and legal power of attorney, and I'm like making decisions that I have no business making. But we decided to sell our properties and buy a place up north because both of my kids had ended up back near Hollister. Well, one was in Santa Cruz and the other one in San Jose. And so I signed the papers to list her house at 9 o'clock in the morning, and then at 3:15 that day, my son was in a horrible motorcycle accident on Highway 17. He had got sober in Alcoholics Anonymous. When he got super tired, he did what most tough guys do. They call their sober mom. And I took him to this Pacific Group camp out at Mono Hot Springs up in the middle of the Sierras, and he detoxed around 80 of my closest friends, and he was not impressed whatsoever. He was homeless and had to bum $20 to get down to the meet point where I could pick him up and take him camping. And I would show up, and he was just being a jerk, and all of my friends were like looking at me, and I'm going like, I'm so sorry. And they would go, shut up and go over there. And I watched Alcoholics Anonymous do this thing. I watched the young folks in AA surround my kid and teach him that he could have a life sober. And then we came back to my home group, and I left the majority of my regular meetings so that Matthew could just go be a Matthew alcoholic, sober member of the Pacific group without having to worry about whether his mom was watching what he was doing in the meetings. And so I went to Monday night and Wednesday night and changed up the entire rest of my meeting schedule, and he got a sponsor. And I gotta tell you, sometimes I think he was the best member of Alcoholics Anonymous in our family. He was the yes guy, man, and he was in love with sobriety and young people and Alcoholics Anonymous. And he'd wear suits to Pacific Group, and then he'd take his tie off and wrap it around his head like a bandana. And they used to call him the PG Ninja. And he would go to like Beyond Baroque Midnight Wrist Slashers meetings and like hook newcomers and bring them to the Pacific Group. That was awesome. And he sponsored a bazillion kids. And he moved up to Scotts Valley because he got a phenomenal job opportunity. And he had 5 years sober. And then all of a sudden, he's almost 6 years sober, and he's in this motorcycle accident. And I get this call at 4 o'clock in the morning. I'm getting ready to get up and go to Clancy's Memorial, and instead, I'm going to the Santa Clara Valley Medical Center. And my son had been pushed under the rear wheels of a semi truck, and he had this crushing, degloving injury, and he lived for the next 69 days in that surgical ICU unit. And I got to show up every single day. Because that's what you guys teach me to do, just show up. And I got to advocate for my son, and I got to make the medical decisions that I wasn't qualified to make, and I got to care for my little mom while I was selling her house and my house and buying another house and hiring movers, and like it was nightmarish. And I remember telling my friend Marty, like, I don't see God in any of this. And Marty said, I see nothing but God in all of this. And I thought, you are stupid. And then what he said was, how do you think you are capable of any of this? And he had me. Like, one more time, he had me. And Maddie lived for 69 days. And on November 5th, I had to make the decision to discontinue his life support. And I had the incredible privilege of climbing into bed with my son and walking him home. And when I said that was one of my lurking notions and reservations, I meant it was the biggest one. And the crazy thing is, like, I'm only capable of doing that because a couple years before that, I watched my friend Marilyn get a phone call. And her beautiful son David had hung himself in his legal office. And she left the state line convention and drove home so she could attend to like the business at hand, right? Like, I watched Marilyn go through the most horrific thing, and then the very next Wednesday I watched her walk into our home group. And so I know if Marilyn's able to do that, I'm able to do that. And the truth is, like, my literature tells me that my dark past is going to become my greatest asset, because with that I avert death and misery for other people. And I believe that no matter how horrific that experience was, there's nothing wasted in God's economy. And in the entirety of the moments that I can't seem to feel and access God, like, I just come in here and I know that God is. And I know that because you mirror that for me every single day since I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. A year and a half later, I got to do the same thing with my mom. I got to climb in bed with her and walk her home. And the crazy thing is, somewhere along the line, Alcoholics Anonymous gave that woman the daughter that she deserved instead of the little rat fink that was presented to her when I popped along. And there was healing, and there was forgiveness, and there was care, and there was love. And I would take her to the doctor, and the doctor would say, you need to go into a home. Who's going to take care of you? And she would get incensed and go, my daughter. And then she would look at me and go, right? And I'm like, heck yeah, Mom. Like, you guys did that. It was nothing that I believe myself capable of. I just walk through, like, the march for one 24-hour period, and I get this incredible life. A couple of years ago, I had this old idea pop into my head that I didn't know was an old idea, and I didn't know was being smashed at the moment I was talking about it. And it sounded something like Chris was the Prince Charming in my fairy tale. And I thought, like, if that's really the truth, there can't be anything available for me in my future. Like, I didn't know it was an old idea. And I didn't know speaking it was making it go away. And I laughed and said, like, oh, let's talk about something else. And then in the thank you line that very day, like, can you believe it? Like, I got to meet Mark, who was my youngest son's boss at the city of Hollister, and we've just been kind of inseparable since. And I love my life right in your midst, and I'm totally out of time. I'm not. I have 10 minutes left, but I'm gonna finish early anyway. Like, I love this deal, and my life seems to work the absolute best when I just got out of the way and let it unfold. My life works the absolute best when I do my best to pay attention to you guys. My own problems seem to die of neglect, and I have a beautiful, rich, full life because I serve Alcoholics Anonymous. And if I do nothing but that every single day for the rest of my life, I could never repay you for the life you've given me, but I'll spend every single day I have left trying. So thank you so much for letting me come and be with you guys.
Thank you, Tina. Let's give her another round.